outside the White House Tuesday for a protest dubbed the Million Mask March. Organized by the hacktivist group Anonymous, participants called attention to issues including NSA surveillance and government corruption. Similar rallies were held in cities worldwide as part of Guy Fawkes Day, the commemoration of a failed effort to blow up the British Parliament in 1605. In London, protesters gathered on the Westminster Bridge to collectively burn their energy bills in what organizers called a bonfire of austerity.
So what people are doing is piling energy bills on the bonfire because at the moment energy bills are soaring because the big six energy companies are effectively holding consumers across the country to ransom. They've hiked energy prices by up to over 10% in many cases at a time of the longest fall in living standards since Queen Victoria sat on the throne of this country. It's going to drive 9 million people into fuel poverty. It is going to kill elderly people as well.
Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has announced a restructuring of his office practices after being accused of plagiarism. Over the past week, Paul has been found to have used other people's language without attribution in a speech, an article, and congressional testimony, and in a section of his book. On Tuesday, Paul acknowledged his office has made mistakes and said he'll ensure his public statements are properly footnoted from now on. The mayor of Canada's largest city is refusing to resign after admitting he used crack cocaine. Toronto's Rob Ford had faced months of controversy following reports of a video showing him smoking from a crack pipe and making bigoted remarks. Toronto police recently announced they'd recovered the video after arresting a Ford associate on charges of extortion. On Monday, Ford acknowledged his crack use to reporters.
Yes, I have smoked crack cocaine. No. Do I? Am I an addict? No.
When have you?
Have I tried it? Probably in one of my drunken stupors, probably approximately about a year ago. I answered your question. You asked the question properly, I'll answer it.
How many
I've made mistakes. All I can do now is apologize and move on. I don't know what All I can say is I've made mistakes. And you guys kept referring to alcohol. There was a couple isolated incidents. There's been times when I've been in a drunken stupor. That's why I want to see the tape.
During the course of their investigation, police surveillance documented Ford exchanging packages with a man ultimately detained for extortion. At a news conference hours after his admission of crack use, Ford apologized to Toronto voters but rejected calls to step down, saying, in fact, he plans to seek.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Friday, November 8th at the Alberta Street Pub, the Creative Music Guild and KBOO are proud to present a special evening with the exciting experimental band known as Kneebody. The Wall Street Journal says putting a finger on a band like Kneebody is a bit like raising it to the wind. At any given moment, the group's artistic inclinations can whip it in unpredictable directions. Opening the show will be the adventurous Portland favorites, Blue Cranes. Blue Cranes' newest album, Swim, shows the band turning yet another musical corner, expanding on their collective and individual strengths while forging into new experimental territory. The Creative Music Guild is an all-volunteer nonprofit promoting experimental and improvised music in Portland for decades. For more information, go to creativemusicguild.org. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Kneebody and Blue Cranes, live at the Alberta Street Pub, 1036 Northeast Alberta, Friday, November 8th. See you there.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Close Guantanamo, a public forum featuring the past president of Veterans for Peace, Elliot Adams, plus Portland's Guantanamo Solidarity Vigilers. Close Guantanamo is co-sponsored by VFP Chapter 72 and the Economic Justice Action and Peace Action Groups of the First Unitarian Church of Portland. Adams will discuss different messages about why we will be better off when Guantanamo is closed from various perspectives. Christian, Muslim, Jewish, those concerned about national security, and the fiscally minded. Close Guantanamo will be at the Elliott Chapel, First Unitarian Church of Portland, on 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue, on November 7th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage, under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Right to Dream 2 dismisses its lawsuit against the city of Portland.
Robin Ryan follows a new Senate report on prison overcrowding.
And we'll take a look at the incoming election results, both locally and nationwide.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 6, 2013. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Right to Dream 2 and the owners of the Portland Old Town property that it's called home for the past 2 years dismissed a lawsuit against the city of Portland today. The dismissal of the lawsuit is a requirement of the settlement signed with the city that calls for waiving more than $20,000 in fines levied against the owners of the property. The city fined the property owners for allowing what they called an illegal campground at the location. The settlement paves the way for a possible move of the homeless camp to a Pearl District parking lot. KBOO reporter Ken Jones spoke with Mark Kramer, the attorney for both Right to Dream 2 and the owner of the Northwest 4th and Burnside property, about the lawsuit dismissal.
What was the reason for the Right to Dream 2 lawsuit?
Right to Dream 2 had been on the property at 4th and Burnside now for more than 2 years, and the city had assessed against the owners large and increasing fines, alleging that this was a recreational campground, that various rules and conditions had not been met, and the fines were increasingly a burden both on the owners and Right to Dream 2's occupancy of the site. We never believed this was a recreational campground like a Boy Scout camp or a Girl Scout camp, rather a rest area for houseless people, and so we challenged the application of those fines and those rules in a lawsuit against the city.
Why did you dismiss the lawsuit today?
The lawsuit dismissal was the result of a negotiated agreement among the city, particularly Commissioner Fritz, and the owners of the property and Right to Dream 2, which involved the dismissal of the lawsuit, the waiver of all fines assessed against the owners, the relocation of Right to Dream 2 from their current site to Lot 7 under the Broadway Bridge, a commitment of the city that if that site could not continue after a year, that another site would be found, and other conditions as part of the settlement. So the dismissal of the case was just part of Right to Dream 2's and the owner's obligations under the settlement agreement.
And you're now, I'm sure, searching for another site for the homeless camp. I know you're talking about the Pearl District parking lot, Lot 7. There's a draft agreement, actually, with the city?
Well, the settlement agreement contemplated a specific relocation site, and that's Lot 7 under the Broadway Bridge. And that site was vetted by the Bureau of Development Services and received their stamp of approval. That went in front of City Council, and there were a number of opponents which testified and opposed the relocation there. And so Right to Dream 2 then at that point and continues now to be open to other sites. So long as another site is accessible to public transportation, accessible to social services, meets the mission statement of Right to Dream 2. So yes, there are other sites now belatedly under consideration, but if those don't work out, then Right to Dream 2 is prepared to move as soon as this final piece, which is a use agreement, is put into place.
What needs to be done to get that use agreement approved and the move to Lot 7 underway?
Well, the draft has been completed by Commissioner Fritz's office, and Right to Dream 2 has suggested some modifications and clarifications, nothing of great substance, and so Commissioner Fritz is working on that now. I imagine that particular piece can be done, you know, within 30 days. The city has promised to help facilitate installing electricity and water. That would just take a few days. The mayor has expressed some reservations about the relocation, and so I'm not sure if he's going to throw a wrench into the works or not.
There's also a group opposed, the Pearl Group. They are currently suggesting an alternate site, possibly an indoor site.
Well, the Pearl Group has never contacted me with any formal site or recommendation or offer. They've gone through back channels. They've gone through the mayor's office. They've gone through the media. They haven't approached Right to Dream 2 directly. Now, just today, again through back channels, they've finally put on the table some particular sites that might be alternatives for Right to Dream 2, some on the east side, some on the west side, and we're going to take a look at those.
The judge said the officer did not have reasonable suspicion for the search. The man who was stopped by the officer had a concealed gun permit and is an advocate for open carry, which allows gun owners to openly carry a gun in public. He said he carries his gun openly in order to remind others of their rights.
The city of Portland announced this afternoon that a tentative agreement has been reached on how the Portland police should carry out the reforms mandated by the U.S. Department of Justice last year. The U.S. Department of Justice carried out an extensive investigation of the use of force by Portland police against people with mental illness after a number of deadly incidents sparked outrage in the community. Today's tentative agreement comes just 1 week before a judge had ordered all legal briefs to be submitted. The Portland police are trying to avoid a trial in federal court by negotiating this out-of-court settlement with the city of Portland and the federal government. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
For people who may not be as familiar with the issue, talk about what the Department of Justice investigation actually found out about the Portland police.
The agreement is in place because the Department of Justice did an investigation, discovered a pattern and practice of the Portland police using excessive force, particularly against people who have or appear to have some form of mental illness. And instead of going to court and having to prove that in the courtroom and having a judge say, okay, now that we've proven that you have conducted yourselves against the Constitution, City of Portland, you have to do these following things, the city and the DOJ worked out this, what we're calling the DOJ agreement. And that's the agreement I keep talking about. The police association filed to become part of that lawsuit back in January, and basically held up the process because they said they didn't want to accept the terms of that agreement. So that until today, it looked like that the hearing was going to happen sometime next summer where the judge was going to decide whether the Department of Justice is correct in their findings that the Portland police use excessive force. At this point, if this agreement, if this side agreement that's been worked up with the police association gets signed, sealed, and delivered, there's not going to be a trial and things will move forward.
Mayor Hales, when he was campaigning, said that he would take real steps to hold the Portland police accountable. Does it seem that he's going back on some of those campaign promises?
Well, it's interesting. The timing of this is all very interesting because just 2 weeks ago, a bunch of us were down at City Council chambers telling the city auditor to slow down trying to change our oversight system. She was actually trying to add some pieces to that system, which would actually make it stronger, but she wasn't willing to go far enough to satisfy some of the things that the community has been asking for many, many years. So we wanted to just, if we're going to fix it, basically we have to fix it right. And at that hearing, the chief came out and said, kind of blatantly, I think everything's working just fine. I don't think see why we have to do any of these changes, which is kind of, I think, off message when you're looking at the bigger picture that the DOJ agreement mandated some of the changes that he was objecting to. But regardless of that, the mayor said, well, let's hold off on for this a while. And even though that seems like it's, in the way it's being portrayed in some of the press, is that that's a bad thing that he said, let's hold off on this, it's actually a very good thing for us in the community because it gives us time to add those extra things that weren't in the auditor's proposal. And now that the DOJ agreement is going to be moving forward, the judge has to hold something called a fairness hearing. And that is our opportunity as a community to come in and say, this is what's good about the agreement, and this is where we need to fix the agreement before we move forward with it.
And when do you have any idea when that fairness hearing might actually be?
No, because I believe the next hearing in front of Judge Simon is on November 18th. And at that hearing, presumably, he will be informed that this agreement either has been signed or is about to be signed, and either he will set the fairness hearing that day or he will say once everything is signed, sealed, and delivered, right, because he might not want to get ahead of himself and set the fairness hearing before he knows that the PPA is actually signed off on this. Then, so either he'll set the fairness hearing on the 18th of November and tell us when that's going to be, or he'll wait, you know, until he gets all this paperwork. So it could be December or January. We don't know when it'll be. But once we do, believe me, KBOO will hear about it, because we're going to need everybody in the community to come out and tell them what we want to add to this agreement in order to make true change to our Portland police and to our oversight system.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Handelman. He is a community activist with Portland Cop Watch on today's tentative agreement that was announced between the Portland Police Union, federal prosecutors, and the city of Portland. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A report issued by the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center earlier this week figured prominently in testimony offered at a Senate hearing about the increase in overcrowding and costs to run the nation's federal prison system. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with research analyst Samuel Taxi, one of the report's authors, about what role sentencing guidelines and mandatory minimums have played in the trend.
I'm talking with Sam Taxi from the Urban Institute. He is one of the contributing authors to a 63-page report called Stemming the Tide, and it concerns overcrowding in the prison system. Can you talk about the causes of the jump in population?
Yeah, a lot of sentencing reform bills were passed in the 1980s that required that people serve a certain length of their sentence and mandated mandatory minimum sentences for a lot of offenses. We did statistical analyses, my colleagues at the Urban Institute, on the drivers of federal prison growth, and most of the growth that we've seen in the past 15 years is from drug offenders, particularly their length of stay in federal prisons.
So the Urban Institute would agree that the doctrine of mandatory minimums did, in fact, play a role in the trend, the dynamic of increased prison population.
What we found is that lengthy drug sentences have had the biggest role in increasing the federal prison population.
Among the list of remedies that the report suggests, that there's a legislative package that refers to a safety valve. Can you explain what that is and how it works?
Sure. There's currently something called the safety valve that allows some drug offenders who are charged with mandatory minimum drug crimes to be, I guess, taken out from under a mandatory minimum. So it applies to only offenders with little to no criminal history who did not use a weapon or violence and did not have a leadership or supervisory role in the commission of the offense. Two of the options in our report look at what expansions to the safety valve would do, either in allowing some drug offenders who still have minimal criminal histories but don't quite qualify now to access that sentence reduction, and also if it applied to other mandatory minimums.
Do you anticipate any opposition to these legislative packages, and if so, by whom?
There will be some opposition. There are some advocates and legislators who believe very strongly that mandatory minimum sentences and lengthy sentences for federal offenders are effective ways at reducing crime. People who believe that the best way to reduce crime is locking people up won't want to reduce the prison population.
Can you share what you anticipate to be the timeline for the moment these legislative packages or bills? How long before they go through the House, the Senate, and then get signed by the President?
That's something that I'm very curious about as well. We're looking forward to seeing which of these bills gains traction. There's been a lot of support, and I guess we're looking forward to seeing what happens.
For folks wanting more information about the report and what you anticipate from here, can you give them some website information?
Yes, the report's available online at urban.org. And there are also links, I believe, to blog posts and summaries of the report that condense, as you mentioned, the 63-page report into something a little bit more digestible.
I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Managing the Federal Bureau of Prisons consumes as much as 25% of the Justice Department's overall budget, and it's expected to increase to 30% by 2018. Taxi conceded that the report did not address what impact for-profit prison vendors had, but according to the Center for Responsive Politics, Corrections Corporation of America has contributed either directly or through lobbying organizations a total of $25 million to lawmakers since 1990.
Top of a national list for least affordable child care. A recent survey conducted by the group Child Care Aware revealed that costs for infant and four-year-old child care as a percentage of parents' income is least affordable in Oregon State. With more, here's KBOO's Stephen Sherritt.
A new national survey confirms what many parents in Oregon already know. The average cost at child care centers is the least affordable in the nation relative to family income. The group Child Care Aware says the average price of infant care tops $13,000 a year. It can eat up 18% of an Oregon couple's income and more than 60% of a single parent's income. Dr. Bobby Weber in the Family Policy Program at OSU says economists don't really know why both child care and housing costs are so high relative to what people make in Oregon. But price is the reason more than half of the preschools are not in child care centers.
The families don't even consider using something that they know doesn't fit in their budget. So it doesn't matter whether they consider it desirable for their child or for them as a family. If I know I can't afford it, why would I even look at it?
Dr. Weber says individual centers do what they can to serve lower-income families, but their profit margin is only 1 or 2%. She says the survey reflects the fact that centers were hit hard by enrollment declines during the recession and had to raise prices to stay in business. She says state funding for the employment-related daycare program is critical for allowing lower-income parents to keep working, but it's also critically underfunded, serving only 1 in 5 children who are eligible. Dr. Weber isn't sure why it hasn't been a legislative priority.
I think there's a fatigue factor when a problem is as big as this one, that decision makers sometimes throw up their hands and say, I can't fix it. If we're serving less than 20%, where would we ever find the money to go to 100%?
She adds there is a bright side. As a member of the governor's Early Learning Council, she says they're hearing a lot from local communities about what they want and need for child care and preschool. She thinks the governor's new definition of education from birth to adulthood will influence the state's commitment to these issues.
That was Stephen Sherritt with KBOO News.
Yesterday, a TriMet bus was quarantined after its driver was diagnosed with whooping cough. The TriMet vehicle was operating on the Line 10 route during the hours of 5:30 to 9:30 a.m. The Oregonian reports that news of the quarantined bus came from a photo posted on Twitter by a TriMet employee yesterday afternoon. The photo showed TriMet bus number 2069 with yellow tape crisscrossing its doors, accompanied by a handwritten sign reading, "Do not enter, infected bus." TriMet failed to issue a statement regarding the quarantine bus and infected driver until earlier this morning. Any riders with concerns about infection are encouraged to contact a physician, the local health department, or to call the Oregon Public Health Division hotline at 1-800-978-3040. That's 1-800-978-3040.
Wall Street analysts, corporate lobbyists, and front groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce form an exuberant cheering squad for maintaining the status quo of America's do-nothing jobs policy. Hooray, they shout to our lawmakers. The unemployment rate is improving. Waving pom-poms of campaign cash and doing statistical backflips, the pep squad instructs Congress to forget a national jobs program, raising the minimum wage, extending unemployment benefits, etc. Push them back, they yell. Well, yes, the official jobless rate has fallen to 7.2%. But don't get giddy, for that's not the total score. In December 2007, when Wall Street's reckless greed crashed our economy, the unemployment rate was only about 5%. The average length of being unemployed was half of today's, and far fewer people were forced into part-time work or had to find multiple jobs to make ends meet. Plus, family income was much higher back then. But there's an even more telling statistic that we rarely hear about, the employment-population ratio. It tells us the number of working-age adults who are in the workforce, meaning they are employed at least part-time or are looking for jobs. This number has plummeted by 5 million people since the crash. They're not working, and they're not counted as unemployed. That's 5 million American workers who, poof, have just disappeared. If we added these, quote, missing workers, as they've been dubbed, to the number of unemployed and underemployed Americans, no one could cheer Washington's do-nothing jobs policy. This is Jim Hightower saying, we need a national milk carton campaign, spreading the photos and names of each of these 5 million missing workers so widely that even Congress would finally recognize that it must do something to boost jobs and wages in our country. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Evening news. Stay tuned after this newscast. Aaron J. Bernard will have an in-depth look at some of the health and environmental measures from yesterday's elections as the results are unfolding, followed by treasures from the KBOO archives at 6 o'clock. Tonight we'll remember the November 13, 1988 killing of Mulugeta Serah by local neo-Nazis. We'll hear a recording from an anti-Tom Metzger rally in 1990 and a speech made by Eleanor Langer, author of 100 Little Hitlers. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. A special weather statement has been issued by the National Weather Service, advising that tomorrow will be wet and windy. The metro area forecast calls for up to a half inch of rain and wind gusts of up to 40 miles an hour. The temperature will reach a high of 54 degrees in Portland. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 32 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 54. Beaverton, it's an average of 28 counts per minute with a high of 51. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 29 CPM with a high of 40. Powell Butte measures 26 CPM with a high of 43. Seaside is experiencing 32 counts per minute with a high of 57. Hanford, Washington has 29 counts per minute with a high of 46. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 35 CPM with spikes up to 60. EPA alert levels start at 100 counts per minute. More information can be found at radcast.org. From yesterday's elections in Washington show a likely defeat of a measure to label genetically modified foods. With three-quarters of the votes in, about 45% of Washington voters opposed Initiative 522, while about 45% voted in favor of labeling all agricultural products, seeds, and seed stock containing GMOs. According to the Seattle Times, opponents outspent proponents 3-1, setting Washington State's record for fundraising by one side during a state initiative battle. The Grocery Manufacturers Association, Monsanto, DuPont, Pioneer, and Bayer Crop Science were primary donors to the $22 million No campaign. This was almost the highest spending initiative in Washington state history, second only to a 2011 liquor privatization initiative in which both sides combined raised approximately $32 million. We'll have more on the story later this hour in a live interview with Mark Schlossberg of Food and Water Watch. Stay tuned.
Citizens in Colorado voted yesterday to approve taxes on legalized marijuana. The aim is to make the tax high enough to generate revenue for enforcement, but low enough to discourage consumers from making black market purchases. The new law includes a 15% excise tax on producers to pay for school construction and a 10% sales tax on consumers to fund enforcement. Legislators can reduce the taxes if they do not yield the desired outcomes. Local government is allowed to add on additional taxes as well.
And now we hear from the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Tougher gun laws is one reason being cited for the Democratic victories in Virginia on Tuesday. Jesse Russell reports.
There are a number of reasons being cited for Democrat Terry McAuliffe's victory over his Republican challenger Ken Cuccinelli in Virginia's gubernatorial race on Tuesday, and polls show guns as being a leading factor. Tom Jensen is director at Public Policy Polling.
26% of Republican voters in Virginia said they were less likely to vote for Cuccinelli because of his stance on background checks. So that was definitely one of the issues that was causing some people who tend to vote for the GOP to really have some doubts about whether Cuccinelli was an appropriate governor.
Americans for Responsible Solutions Executive Director Pia Corazone said Virginia shows that gun extremism is no longer a winning position in the United States.
Gun extremism is not a winning message in this country anymore, and including in states like Virginia, south of the Mason-Dixon line, that have a history of gun ownership, the way Arizona and other states do.
Gerardo Hernandez, the TSA officer shot to death at LAX last Friday, was a member of the American Federation of Government Employees Union. A memorial fund has been established by the family, and the union is supportive of that effort. David Bohr is AFGE's general counsel. He says the union wants to see armed federal law enforcement officers stationed at airport TSA checkpoints, but doesn't want TSA officers themselves to be armed.
What we've proposed is that TSA adopt a force of trained law enforcement officers in uniform with weapons stationed at every checkpoint to protect our officers and the traveling public.
The LAX shooter was intensely anti-government, and Bohr says that right-wing government-hating political rhetoric is an important factor in this tragedy.
The right-wing media and certain members of Congress have absolutely demonized TSA since the day it started, and they talk constantly about our officers as if they're the enemy. And that kind of rhetoric, you don't shout fire in a crowded theater. Well, these officers are not the enemy. And that kind of rhetoric now, the people who have been saying those things need to own a piece of what happened on Friday.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender. Doing whatever it takes to meet your business lending needs for new construction, remodeling, or building training facilities. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News will leave the air November 15th unless a significant amount of emergency money is raised very quickly. We're fighting hard to make sure WIN stays on the air. Go to laborradio.org and hit the donate button to pay your labor news dues. Listener support will help us stay on the air. Laborradio.org and click the donate button now. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
In Bangladesh, a special court gave death sentences to more than 150 soldiers Tuesday at a mass trial of those involved in a 2009 mutiny. More than 70 people were killed, including 57 officers and a dozen members of their families, as a result of this massacre. The judge handed down death penalties for 152 soldiers and life sentences for 161 others who used looted weapons to spur a killing spree. During that mass killing, people were shot, hacked to death, or burned alive, and then dumped into sewers and shallow graves. Other soldiers and some civilians were sentenced to shorter jail terms. Soldiers carried out the uprising after their long-standing demands for higher pay and better treatment were ignored. The judge was particularly incensed by the treatment of the dead, but allowed that the soldiers should have received better treatment. Civil rights groups criticized the proceedings, saying that a mass trial cannot guarantee justice.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the bodies of seven unidentified men have been found outside of a southern Afghan province. There are conflicting reports as to their identities. Authorities believe that the men are civilians killed by the Taliban on suspicion of cooperating with the government. Other reports say that they may be National Afghan Army soldiers who disappeared while traveling from Kandahar province to their homes a week ago. In Kabul, the Afghanistan Ministry of Finance has said that over $5 million has been stolen from its bank account. According to reports, a substantial amount of the stolen money was withdrawn using forged checks. A spokesman from the ministry stated that two of its employees have been arrested and are under investigation.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, November 6, 2013. U.S. Secretary of State visit Bethlehem City, while Israeli troops attack resident shops in Jerusalem and kidnap three civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday afternoon several Palestinian-owned shops in occupied East Jerusalem and kidnapped three civilians. Residents said that the Israeli soldiers targeted a number of computer shops, searched and ransacked them, then took the owners away. In the political news, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told reporters today that the U.S. is against Israeli construction in the West Bank settlements and that his country considers the Israeli settlements as illegal. Kerry made his comments during a press conference as part of his visit to the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem today. He met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and other community and religious leaders, then visited the Church of Nativity, the birthplace of Jesus Christ. Earlier in the week, the Israeli government announced 1,900 new homes to be built in West Bank settlements. In response, the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah threatened to quit talks. Israeli sources have reported that direct Israeli-Palestinian negotiation session held on Tuesday ended with crisis due to sharp differences between the stance of the Israeli and Palestinian negotiators. Palestinians agreed to direct talks with Israel under U.S. supervision when Israel agreed to halt settlement construction in the West Bank and release a number of political detainees held by Israel since before the Oslo Peace Accords of 1991. According to international law, all Israeli settlements built in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, home to nearly 500,000 settlers, are illegal. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, November 6, 2013, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Tomorrow marks 50 days since the activists on the Greenpeace vessel Arctic Sunrise were detained by the Russian Coast Guard. As the Russian government has yet to try the group of activists known as the Arctic 30, the Dutch government has brought the issue to an international court to plead for their release. KBOO reporter Jamai Cherry spoke with a Greenpeace member to find out about the case the Netherlands has laid out.
So what was the case that was brought out by the Dutch government on behalf of the Arctic Sunrise?
Okay, so the Dutch government launched an arbitration process on behalf of the Arctic Sunrise and the 30 individuals on board. And they have the legal right to launch this arbitration because the Greenpeace ship is a Dutch-flagged ship. So it's within their rights to take this request to the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea. And their request is asking this tribunal to look at the events that took place on September the 18th and 19th. And they're arguing that the Russian authorities were acting in opposition to international law, and they illegally boarded and seized the Arctic Sunrise, and so the Dutch government has intervened to see if they can ask for the release of the ship and also for the release of 30 individuals on board.
And what has the Russian government, has there been any response from them in regards to this yet?
No official response from the Russian government. I mean, what's happened with the Arctic 30 is that they are currently within the Russian legal system. What's happening with the Dutch government is that they're taking it to an international body. So there's sort of two separate things happening at this point, and we haven't heard any official response from the Russian government.
Now, the Arctic 30 are being held for hooliganism? Is that what they said that the charges were?
Yeah. So initially, all 30 individuals were actually charged with piracy, which is completely out of proportion with the peaceful protests that they were involved with. And then more recently, the Russian investigative committee announced publicly that they would drop the piracy charges and replace those charges with hooliganism. But as things stand right now, the piracy charges have not been dropped, and all 30 have been charged with hooliganism in addition to the piracy charges. So we're a little unsure why the piracy charges haven't been dropped yet. The maximum sentence for piracy is 15 years in prison, and the maximum sentence for a hooliganism charge is 7 years in prison.
And how long have the Arctic 30 been in detention?
They've been detained. It'll be 50 days tomorrow that they've been, I would say, illegally detained. You know, the ship was seized in international waters. Their charges that have been laid against them for piracy and hooliganism are completely disproportionate. Nothing that they did was violent. It was completely peaceful, and the response that they were met with you know, from the Russian Coast Guard, with open fire and guns and knives, was a very strong and violent reaction.
So, what would Greenpeace like to see be the outcome of this?
Our hope is that the International Tribunal will look at the facts and understand that our ship was illegally seized. We can't, of course, you know, make any judgment call at this point about what's going to happen. But we're just going to be patient and wait for the decision to come forward. What I would want to bring this back to is the reason why this protest was organized in the first place. Oil drilling in the Arctic is a very risky and destructive endeavor. We don't want to see an oil spill happen anywhere in the world, and because these oil drilling operations are starting to happen in the Arctic, we want to make sure that the world's attention is drawn to that kind of destructive industry.
That was KBOO reporter Jemai Cherry speaking with Farah Khan, an Arctic campaigner with Greenpeace.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Stephen Sherritt, Aaron J. Bernard, and Ken Jones. The producer is Jemai Cherry. Special thanks to our engineer, Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock is Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty looks towards next steps in the Department of Justice investigation and settlement with the Portland Police. Can the Portland community expect police accountability? When will the public have a chance to weigh in? Tune in and find out. At 9 o'clock, it's a special one-hour version of Fight the Empire. Host Per Fagering speaks with Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch Institute, on the geopolitics of food scarcity. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, Portland writer Rob Yardumian discusses his debut novel, The Sound of Songs Across the Water, and the accompanying music CD, Sing With Me, Brother, For We Have Sinned. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the topic is independent booksellers, with guests Michael Hicks of Black Rose Books, Phyllis Benton of Midnight Ramble Films, and host Obie Hill of Reflections Mirror Image Books. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our fall membership drive. It is still not too late to join, so go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News, and have a great evening.
are listening to the Rare Silk compilation out this week on Omega Supreme Records. This is Aaron J. Bernard for KBOO Radio. November 5th marked General Election Day for states across the nation, and the votes are rolling in on a host of hot-button health and environmental issues. Among them, anti-fracking initiatives in Colorado and Ohio, and new genetically engineered food labeling requirements in Washington State that have attracted big corporate dollars and big grassroots pushback. To help us make sense of the results, I'm speaking with Mark Schlossberg, National Organizing Director for Food and Water Watch. How are you doing, Mark?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. So let's get started. A lot of big health and environmental issues are on the ballot, so can you take us through the highlights?
Yeah, well, definitely the highlight of the election has been the fracking measures in Colorado. There are four different communities placed measures to stop fracking on the ballot. The oil and gas industry spent nearly $900,000 to try and defeat them. But despite that overwhelming amount of money being spent, three of the four measures have passed. And the fourth one in Broomfield is still to be determined, with only a 13-vote differential between the yes and no side.
So what are these referendums going to do?
They would place a moratorium on fracking within the city limits for certain periods of time, or restrict fracking altogether. And this is becoming an increasingly large issue in Colorado as fracking gets closer and closer to large population centers. The governor of Colorado, Governor Hickenlooper, is an unabashed champion of fracking and an apologist for the oil and gas industry. So last year, a measure passed in Longmont, Colorado, and that spawned other communities to take similar action. And what we're seeing is that when people organize and they come together, they can really fight back, push back, and win, even in the face of overwhelming financial advantage by the oil and gas industry.
Let's go now to Washington, where a GMO labeling ballot initiative is languishing with about a quarter of the votes still out. Can you talk a little bit about this initiative and the corporate money that was invested in fighting it?
Yeah, I-522 is the measure that was on the ballot in Washington. It was very simply label food that has been genetically engineered. And the big junk food and chemical companies spent upwards of $22 million to launch a campaign of misinformation against it. Proponents were outspent about 3-1. And this follows a pattern of the big junk food and chemical companies following on their massive expenditures in California last year. But the results are still not final yet. There's a lot of votes still to be counted. So we're going to wait and see how those come in tonight and in the days to come. But the one thing I will say is that the movement to label genetically engineered foods has never been stronger. This year, there were two measures that passed in Maine and Connecticut to label genetically engineered foods, and there were also similar efforts in states across the country. Those two passed, and it's the first time that labeling laws have passed state level, and we anticipate the fight to continue and continue to grow. The lesson from this year's election is that when people organize, they can push back and win, even in the face of overwhelming financial advantage from big corporate interests. But it also highlights the fact that our political system is in many ways broken. When there's such huge spending disparities and corporations can spend such large amounts of money against very popular progressive measures, there's something wrong with the way that the system operates.
So are there any other big defeats or successes in this voting cycle that you'd attribute to big corporate dollars?
Yeah, there was a measure in Maine that would have made it more difficult in South Portland to... basically made it so that that the tar sand oil could not be exported there. That measure had $600,000 of corporate money against it, and it lost by just a little over 100 votes. Still, the mayor of South Portland has basically stated that he's going to continue to try and keep the tar sand out of his city. Other measures in Ohio there were three measures of fracking measures in Ohio as well. One of them in Overland passed, two in Bowling Green and Youngstown were defeated, and the one in Youngstown, at least I know, faced huge amounts of spending from the no side. Still, this is the second year in a row that they put this measure on the ballot, and it was closer this year than it was in previous year.
Okay, going back to Washington, if the GMO initiative does end up being defeated there, what are some of the next steps for organizations like yours that are advocating for genetically modified labeling?
Well, I think to really win labeling and to really win real reforms in our food system, we have to do kind of deep organizing at the state and local level and in congressional districts. We need to organize, we need to bring people together and continue to build political power to really demonstrate to our elected officials that they need to listen to what the people want.
It's also interesting that voters in the rural parts of Washington mainly voted against this initiative, while the urban areas like Seattle voted for it. So I'm hoping you can comment on the logic behind this, because one would think that farmers and those in farming areas would be in favor of labeling GMOs, particularly GMO seed stock.
Well, there was a large farming constituency that was supportive of I-522. And I think what you're seeing is part of the way that money is spent and the impact of campaign spending. I mean, the no side spent a tremendous amount of money to try and defeat I-522, and the yes side had much less funds to compete in the air war. Now, we know that organizing can defeat big money expenditures, and we see this in Colorado. We've seen this in other places. But it's when you have a kind of door-to-door operation, like we had in the ones in Colorado, you can really get the word out person to person, neighbor to neighbor, and cut through a lot of the misinformation that's being spread by the opposition. And so I think that, you know, when you get into a larger state and a larger area, the impact of television has a much bigger impact. In order to really build a vibrant food movement, that one that has political power to get these measures passed, whether Washington passes or doesn't pass, ultimately, we need to do more organizing. We need to do more to also put pressure on our elected officials. They should be representing their constituents, and the constituents are the ones who actually vote these guys into office. And so we need to have people confronting their elected officials and telling them that they expect them to represent them, not the big junk food and chemical companies, or in the case of fracking, the oil and gas industry, or any other large corporate interest that really whose number one interest is making a profit, not necessarily doing what's best for the people.
Do you have any other thoughts on what these election results tell us about the state of grassroots organizing efforts in this country?
I think the lesson is that grassroots organizing can be very successful. I mean, Colorado, I just keep coming back to it because it's, this is the second year in a row where we've seen community come together, do real organizing, go door to door, person to person, neighbor to neighbor, and pass measures in the face of overwhelming opposition. I mean, this we're talking 30-1 or more in terms of political spending. And so what the lesson for this is that organizing does work. So we have to do that hard organizing. And if we do, we can build political power. What's happening in Colorado is very interesting because you had started with one community last year. Now you've got four communities that have put these things on the ballot, and three have passed and one might. And you're hearing talk about, really taking this to the state level. You've got a governor in Colorado who depends on these communities for his base of support that is basically undermining, because of Governor Hickenlooper, that is undermining the ability of these communities to protect themselves. And in fact, has threatened legal action and has taken legal action to prevent communities from protecting themselves from fracking. And this is going to, kind of become a bigger and bigger problem for him as communities become more and more assertive of their rights to protect themselves. And it's something that is really a model for how organizing can work. We've seen it work also in New York so far as Governor Cuomo has held off decision to go forward with fracking. We've seen it in community after community that has basically push back on efforts to privatize water, and we've stopped many water privatization fights. So we need to build strong coalitions. We need to do lots of grassroots organizing, and we need to build on whatever happens in Washington to go forward and make a strong statement that we expect food to be labeled, we expect food to be healthy, and we don't want to have a food system that's controlled by large corporations, and we don't want to have a democracy that's controlled by them either.
It's early, but do any of these results give us a window into voter sentiment as we look ahead to congressional and gubernatorial elections in 2014?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what you're seeing is that people are beginning to organize more and more around kind of basic issues that really make a big difference in people's lives. Things like engineering of food and things like water and fracking, which impacts our water and our air, those are basic things to people, and people care about those, and they're not going to settle for corporations ruining them or ruining our political system. So I think you're going to see more and more of people holding their congressional representatives accountable, their governors accountable. And let's remember, there's a presidential election in 2016, and a lot of these issues, particularly fracking, has been one that has already been talked about in terms of Governor Cuomo and his potential run for office, Governor Hickenlooper and others who have, maybe presidential aspirations, but need to realize that when people are going to be looking at who they're going to vote for or support, they may consider, whether or not they're supporting large corporations' interests over the interests of the people.
We've got a few minutes left, Mark, and I'm wondering if you could just briefly let us know what else is on the radar for Food and Water Watch.
Yeah, so there's a few kind of big things coming down the pipe. This issue of fracking, this has been an off-year election. There have been these measures on the ballot in Colorado, but this is an issue that is really coming to the fore. Food and Water Watch has worked with several of our partners to build a coalition called Americans Against Fracking. And as President Obama pushes increasingly for a fracked gas and oil energy policy that is part of his climate action plan, you're going to be seeing more and more communities rising up and saying, not just at the local level, but at the federal level, you cannot be a climate champion and support fracking. It's inconsistent, and it's something that really President Obama on down need to take action against. You're also going to see more organizing on labeling of genetically engineered foods in states across the country. This is an issue, whether Washington wins or loses, that is not going away. It's a national issue, and there's going to be legislation in New York, New Jersey, Illinois, Florida, and elsewhere to require labeling of genetically engineered foods and other issues in our food system that impact the way that people's lives. This issue about antibiotics being, antibiotics losing their vitality because of their overuse and use on animal agriculture. That's something that needs to be addressed, and we should not be using antibiotics on animals. It's making our own antibiotics not work, and it's going to make it so that we have a harder time dealing with our health issues in addition to the factory farming issues. And then the larger issue that is going to be that we're working on and kind of working within the system is, our broken political system and our broken democracy. And that's something that we really need to address, not just for food and water, but really for all issues that we work on and care about, and for the, the continued functioning of our democratic system. We've got to get money out of politics, and we've got to, rein in this out-of-control political spending that's poisoning our democracy.
Great. Well, we have just about a minute left. Is there anything else you'd like to add about this voting cycle in particular?
No. I mean, it was there weren't that many measures on the ballot, and obviously it's not a congressional election, so I think we hit the high points. But I would encourage your listeners, if they're interested in some of these issues and want to get involved, to go to our website at foodandwaterwatch.org. We've got a organizer based in Oregon, in Portland. And we're always looking to get more people involved in our organization and our allied organizations and really just in the movement to protect our food, water, and our democracy.
For KBOO Radio, this has been Aaron J. Bernard speaking with National Organizing Director for Food and Water Watch, Mark Schlossberg. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks a lot.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 in Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
The KBOO Foundation, licensee of non-commercial FM radio station KBOO 90.7, Portland, Oregon, gives notice that on October 29, 2013, an application, FCC Form 315, for consent to transfer control of the license from the old board to the new board of directors was filed with the Federal Communications Commission. Officers and directors of the old board were Paula Small, Michael Papadopoulos, Hadrian Machiche, S.W. Konser, Mark Brown, Lynn Mollick, Lisa Loving, Jeff Kippelman, John Mackey, Damon Isaiah Turner, Matthew Bristow, and Rabia Yeaman. Officers and directors of the new board are Matthew Bristow, Adine Rogovin, Mark Sherman, Susan Bartlett, Joe Uris, Jennifer Davis, Michael Wells, Lynn Mollick, S.W. Konser, Michael Papadopoulos, Timothy Welp, and Jeff Kippelman. A copy of the application and related materials are available for public inspection at KBOO's main studio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., Monday through Friday.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Visegrad Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are now listening to Archive Radio.
Tonight on Treasures from the KBOO Vault, we will go back to 1990 and to 2003 to remember the November 13th, 1988 killing of Mulugeta Sarah by members of the Portland neo-Nazi group